Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 3rd, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Karen Bloomquist. Today's session number is 98-6, and it is titled, Towards Sufficient Sustainable Livelihood for All, Gambling. Let's listen in.
My name is Karen Bloomquist, and this is my second week this summer on the teaching staff. I teach theological ethics at Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa, and I'm also the ELCA, or Director of Studies in the ELCA Division for Church and Society, which is the division through which the studies and statements on social issues are developed. This particular week, I thought it might be helpful for us to be spending some time engaging with this particular first draft of an economic life social statement. I had my office ship lots and lots of copies here, so you can get your copy free. In fact, I have a whole stack of them on the table outside here, so feel free to help yourself to one.
Do we need it today? Should we have it?
No, and you don't need it today, because it's kind of a preface to that. We're going to have a little different focus or conversation today. As you heard announced, we're especially going to be talking about the incredible growth, spread, and size of gambling, particularly in U.S. society today. I know we have Canadians in our midst too, and I think some of you can provide some perspective as to what's going on in Canada. And I think this is a case in point where yesterday three of us were sitting around at breakfast, and Gary and Jenny over here from Colorado were beginning to talk about the huge ethical dilemma facing their community in Colorado, and I'm going to ask them to share a little bit about that case study a little bit later, but I'm going to spend maybe the first third or so laying out some basic perspectives. As I was talking to them, I said, oh yeah, one of the things that our division has developed recently is a study on gambling. Have any of you seen this prior to coming to Holden? One person, okay. And there were, at least this morning, about half a dozen copies for sale in the bookstore. There's four left, okay. So as we're talking about this, and if you're saying, well, gee, you know, that's really an issue we need to talk about more in our congregation, I have prepared a list here. And so if you don't buy one, and they're only a dollar, but if you don't buy a copy in the bookstore here, you can sign a copy, and actually I will fill these orders, and we'll just send you a complimentary copy later on, but you won't get that one until maybe 3-4 weeks from now. So let me begin by first of all saying some things about gambling, and I'll also say some things about how I think this is a kind of preface or maybe a kind of foil to begin with for talking about the wider theme of sufficient sustainable livelihood for all, which is the overall theme for this week. When we think about gambling, I think the first thing that we need to recognize is that there really isn't a clear prohibition against gambling in the Bible. Even though it's probably been one of those issues where there's been a lot of, you know, moralistic fervor, at least in earlier periods of our history, raised about gambling, there's not really a clear prohibition. And the position that at least our Lutheran Church in this country has is that it's not the ethical issues related to gambling are not that gambling is necessarily intrinsically wrong. And yet, the kind of scope and size of gambling, especially within the last 10 years in this country, causes me to feel that that gambling dramatically epitomizes the false promise at the heart of a vision that is diametrically opposed to the biblically based vision of sufficient, sustainable livelihood for all. In other words, that broader theological theme that we're going to want to explore and say, well, what does that mean in terms of our practices and policies, not only in this country, but globally? So to make, to give you some background as to why I'm making that claim, just a bit about its size and scope. And first of all, it might be helpful for us to do a little bit of a survey. How many of us live in communities that are within a short distance of some kind of casino?
Yeah.
Wow.
Everybody. Okay. Riverboat, American Indian casinos. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about here. Maybe some of you live in Nevada and places like that. Or how many of you live in states with state-sponsored lotteries? Just about everybody. 37 states, at least in 1996, that was the figure. Or video lottery terminals. That's kind of the crack cocaine version. In other words, you don't have to wait till the nightly showing on TV of who won the lottery. Or horse or dog racing. Those are probably older forms. Now, I just think of every hand in the room went up when I asked about being within a short drive of a casino. Maybe that's why you came to this particular session. Now, if we were sitting here 35 years ago in 1963, there were no state-sponsored lotteries in the United States, and only one state permitted casino gambling, and I think we all know that that would be Nevada. Now, in contrast to that picture 35 years ago, in 1996, and I think these figures may be higher than this by now, but these are the figures that are at least used in this study, close to $600 billion a year is wagered. $600 billion wagered. And close to $50 billion a year is earned by the various kinds of gambling operations. In other words, gambling has certainly become a big business. It's cleaned up its image. It's now, you know, various gambling-related stocks are sold on the stock market. So it's, and I think in general what we've seen in the last few decades is a significant shift where probably for many of us when we were growing up, there was a sense that gambling is, well, immoral. You really don't want to let anybody know that you've gone to Vegas. To now, it's become an acceptable form of recreation. Just a year and a half ago, we, on our way to the Grand Canyon, passed through Las Vegas, and you know, just, you know, the kind of creation of a whole virtual reality in the huge, huge casinos there, and the kind of draw that they have, and you know, the fact that it's become a big entertainment industry, a much different image of gambling than might have been the case when it was seen a bit shady, and well, you know, whoever's involved in gambling is a little bit suspicious.
Having lived in Las Vegas, you know, we didn't have gambling, we had a gaming industry.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yes, and you're right. And certainly, in these this cleaned up image is to talk about it as gaming rather than gambling. And then I'd like for us to just think for a few minutes about, or for a few moments about, the message that gambling basically conveys. You too can get lucky, you can win it all, you can win the money that will result in the good life and all of the advertisements and all the commercials that set forth that promise, that hope, that dream. All of life is a big game of chance based on random luck where the winner takes all. Now I think whether or not we participate in gambling, it's possible to say that, hey, that's a theme that's pretty common in our society. It goes just beyond, you know, whether one is involved in gambling. The logic of gambling is based on a belief that the universe is arbitrary. All kinds of understandings of what the world is about that are really quite different from some Christian understandings of the talk about God's providence, God's care, God's sustenance. And so there's an underlying assumption behind this kind of, well, you know, I'm going to blow it all gambling or whatever. I'm going to take my chance, no matter how remote those chances are. It's quite different from an understanding that is a part of what we confess in the first article of the Creed, when we talk about God creating all that is, and God somehow having a hand with us, but a hand in what is and what the future will unfold. Rather than people staking their hope on God's promise, which by faith we confess will come about, and I'm talking here about the promise that all will have what they need to live an abundant life, instead of staking their hope there, an increasing number of people stake their hope on what in some states has become a 1 in 80 million odd. 1 in 80 million chance. You know, your chances is 1 out of 80 million that you will hit it big, that you will win the big lottery. Mm. Rather incredible odds. Now, some in analyzing the phenomena of gambling have said, well, yeah, there's gambling, but gambling, in a sense, epitomizes what has become more and more of a casino kind of society. Casino as kind of a metaphor, an image for a whole way of thinking in our society. The idea that, well, some will win big, and others will lose and get stuck on the bottom. We in the United States have become, says Jacob Weisberg, and this was in a New York Times Magazine article several months ago, we have become, quote, united shareholders of America. Now here he begins to slide from talking about that to talking about what happens in the stock market. Now I want to, before I get into this, I want to say I think there are some significant differences between, you know, betting your $100 on, you know, in gambling and losing it all, and for example, most stocks that you might have bought 10 years ago with $100, chances are, given what's happened to the stock market in this country anyway, that, you know, you probably made something with that $100. So I think there are some significant differences there. But still, I want you to hear this critique that Weisberg is raising. We are developing a mass culture of investing where a dollar gained is replacing the adage a dollar earned, or a dollar won would be the way that this would play itself out in gambling. By setting up speculative riches as an aspiration, whether those gains occur through low-stakes gambling or high-stakes investing, it belittles the traditional virtues of industry and thrift. The American dream is no longer a middle-class standard of living for all. It's retirement in early age for the fortunate few who can live off the killing they've made through gambling, through one means or another. So there's a sense in which our whole, you know, those, a lot of those adages that probably many of us grew up with, you know, are shifting in terms of what the reality is of what we hear in all the kinds of aspirations that are set out there for us.
When we were living in Las Vegas, as John mentioned, there was a couple who went to our church, and the father worked for the school district, I think, as an assistant superintendent. Remember Jim? And what did his wife do? I don't remember.
She was a teacher, too.
She was a teacher, too.
But the highest his son could attain to was to be a dealer. Had no interest in education, you know, with that background. I mean, it's true, bad.
Yeah, he was a junior or a senior in high school, and I think he did work at the golf course in the summer as a caddy or something, but he really had no interest in going to college. Mm-hmm. Didn't make any sense to him.
me just put one little piece here on the table, and that is to list what have been four of the reasons why Christians traditionally have been concerned about gambling. I've already said that I don't think it's quite accurate to say gambling is intrinsically wrong. But four of the reasons that Christians have traditionally had some real reservations about gambling is the way in which gambling and really getting caught up in gambling can encourage sins of greed and covetousness. We heard in the sermon last night a lot on that particular theme. Secondly, the emphasis on chance can be an occasion for despair or distrust in what it is that God provides. Thirdly, it can lead to a misuse of the stewardship of our time, our talents, our resources. Certainly if one's looking at some of the gambling addictions that are maybe percentage-wise not that numerous. The figure is often pegged as 1 to 5% are compulsive gamblers, and yet they end up gambling a pretty significant amount of their income in many cases. And fourth, gambling can place vulnerable members of our communities at risk of great harm. I want to read a quote from David Kruger, who's actually a member of our Economic Life Task Force, and this is from an article he had published some years ago in Christian Century. So I think it's a helpful way of looking at what it is that gambling symbolizes. He writes, "Gambling's appeal to the non-affluent suggests a general malaise and absence of belief in the capacity of themselves and of the institutions of our society to create adequate opportunity and well-being for large segments of our society. Do many believe that gambling has become the only real hope to better their lives?" In other words, being so caught up in gambling for some people may in fact be their only hope, what they hope will be the way they'll make it, if in fact, for a lot of other reasons, including cut back and some of the support that other institutions have provided for them in the past, when that help is no longer there. The statistics tell us that those who are poor spend more on especially the lottery in absolute terms, not merely proportional terms, but absolute dollars. And when you think that a lot of state-run lotteries are for the purpose of raising funds for schools or for one purpose or another, in other words, they are taking the place of taxes, we have to say, hey, we're really raising public funds, therefore, on the back of those who are the poorest. Now, and obviously, they're voluntarily participating in that activity. But proportionally, not just proportionally, but in absolute terms, the poor spend far more on the lottery than those who are not poor. But I think one of the key factors that we especially need to look at, and what I think the case study we want to talk about a little bit this afternoon we'll get at, is the effect of large-scale gambling operations, especially when a community really turns to gambling as a way of engaging in economic development, generating tax revenues, generating jobs, and what is the effect on the common good, and what kinds of challenges does that raise for others who live in that community, including for the church. And so as a way of getting us into that discussion, as well as some of these other moral dilemmas related to gambling, I'm going to invite Gary and Ginny to tell us a little bit about the situation in Blackhawk, Colorado, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, well, we're Gary and Ginny Black, and we moved to an address of Golden, Colorado in 1989. But we really live close to Blackhawk. Golden's about 20 miles away from us, straight west of Denver. It's a very high elevation. We're at 2 miles high. And that's where Blackhawk is. We're about 3 miles from Blackhawk. So we moved there in 89. We moved from Redwood Falls, Minnesota back to Colorado. And we really liked this little mining community there. It was kind of a suburb of Denver. And I was like many other people who live in this area. We could drive to Denver. It was an hour away. And like for 3 years, I worked at Detroit Diesel. So I'd go, you know, out in the Monday morning and come back either Thursday night or Friday night. So Blackhawk was a little tiny mining town. It's adjoined by Central City. And then further down, just west of Colorado Springs, is Cripple Creek. And these are three old mining towns. So in November of 1991, there was a statewide election of all of Colorado. And what was happening was these three little mining towns and other towns that were like that had a dropping economic base. They were trying to become tourist towns, but they really couldn't have a lot of people coming to the tourist town. So gradually the economic base was disintegrating slowly and surely. So they got this bright idea. They'd had gambling, I guess, there years and years ago, back when they were really mining. Of course, these were the beginning towns in Colorado. You know, these were the first towns, and then Denver was just a base camp to supply the mining towns. So they said, if we could just have a few slot machines in here, in this little grocery store and all these other little stores, we could really do well. And that was what started this whole concept. And they really believed this would happen. And so you talk to them today, they really did believe that this there was such a thing as a little bit of gambling. Well, there isn't any such thing as a little bit of gambling. So in 1991, it was passed, I think, I don't remember the numbers, like 60% to 40%. Since then, they've had some other elections of other towns wanting to qualify as, and it qualified as historical preservation. That's the way they sold it. Now it's defeated by about 80 to 20. I don't know why that is, if people think this wasn't such a good idea or because they don't want to have more gambling or whatever. But the whole concept was historical preservation. And this is different than most gambling communities because they have, you know, it's Indians or, you know, various other things. This was all historical preservation of the mining towns, and a certain amount of the funds were set aside for historical preservation. So that was the beginning. Now, what happened as the gambling came in, they rapidly figured out a way around these restrictions where you could just have three or four, you know, slot machines in your store. They figured out a way of redoing the square footage so that you could just cover your store with gambling machines. So gambling pushed everything out. It pushed out the post office, the bank, all the gas stations, and just anything that was dedicated as in the mining or the gambling area was pushed out, except a few churches that are still left. So now it's switched. Historical preservation turned out to be kind of a facade, because what you do is you just keep one wall of the building and take everything else out. They've totally given up on that now, and they have just big mining or just big casinos coming in. They're very much like Las Vegas style casinos now. They're huge. In fact, I guess Blackhawk just passed Atlantic City and has moved into second place. So it's very big. And these are huge casinos, and they're just going in. Every one is bigger than the one before. And what this does is it pushes out all the small ones, and they go bankrupt or whatever. And they're just really big casinos. So we go to this little church in the middle of Blackhawk. There's one church in Blackhawk, and there's three in Central City. And we've lost about half of our congregations, approximately half, all four congregations, as people have moved out. Blackhawk had a population of 220, Central City 320, and that's probably dropped in half. Now, there's a lot more people in, but they bus in the morning, the casino workers, and then the gamblers all drive and bus in. So the Clear Creek Road is just thick with traffic. We have many accidents, particularly between 1 and 3 in the morning when there's a lot of intoxication. One of the things that Karen was interested in and wanted me to bring up was just the reaction of the churches. You know, we've been, you know, it's been overwhelmingly negative to us, and we're trying to survive, losing about half the membership. You know, like our big problem in Black Hawk was parking. We parked just across the street in this empty lot, and now everything is valuable. The land is worth approximately $1,200 a square foot in the gambling area now, so you can see the intensity that, you know, we have no parking places, and people just don't want to come to church in a place like this. Churches have reacted, and the thing Karen is interested in, have reacted differently to, you know, whether we would take historical preservation money. They have a big surplus of historical preservation money because nobody is taking it, or a lot of people aren't taking it. And so they're moving houses, you know, some of the historical houses in that kind of a historical housing area. The Methodist Church, which is the oldest church in Colorado, which is located in Central City, they have decided to take gambling money for the upkeep of that building. And our church decided not to, which is kind of a hard decision to make because we don't, obviously, we don't have any money. And so we have decided to not take historical preservation money. So this was a hard, you know, decision to make, one that we talked about. So it's totally going to change the town. Gilpin County has only about 2,500 people when we moved there. Probably has about 3,500 now. But they're starting to build apartment houses for the casino workers. Some of the apartment houses are as large as 4,000 units. So it's quite obvious that the power, the political power, everything will switch to the casino workers. Now, this is neither good nor bad. It's just factual. And I don't know what this all means, but the casino workers will, at some point in time, have, you know, the power of the county. One of the things that Jenny and I have been interested in is, you know, how do you bring a mission to these people? And I have talked to some of the developers, and they're totally willing to have, for various purposes, I suppose, you know, dedicate buildings that you could have church services in there. Because they don't really, I don't think, would feel comfortable coming to our little church, you know. These churches are small and they're old and they're different kinds of people. They're all commuters to Denver. So they are open to doing that. So that's one of the things we're looking at is perhaps getting some kind of a casino worker ministry going. I have no idea if that will be successful or what will happen. But anyway, that's just a quick rundown of what's happened. What have I missed telling you about? So that's a quick rundown of Black Hawk. Black Hawk and Central City, they run together. They're actually, the boundary of Black Hawk actually joins Central City.
Well, geography is, there's this mountain and the railroad, and then just a small strip that you can really do anything on. So they had to take over the...
Yeah, it's a very good point. This is a very, you know, if you've never been there, it's a very narrow valley where they found the gold veins there.
There's
first
no
on
place
the surface. There's no place to go. And it's very tight, and so they're building in there now, and it's on the roads coming in. But the dollars are such that the Hyatt, which is just coming in with a huge casino, the gambling, where this gambling zone is, that's where they're building, and there's a mountain in the way. They're taking the mountain out.
Oh, really?
That to me is a powerful metaphor. I mean, talk about, not metaphor, but a powerful example of power. Right.
They're moving
the mountain. We'll move nature. Nature gets in the way, even a mountain.
We just move it in, just move it out. And they're thinking about putting in another new road in, you know. I suppose in years we'll have helicopter service in there. Who knows what? But it is very tough, and we have no control over, you know, the church. Various people have approached us on selling it. It's very interesting. We have no control on it at all. Of course, the land is worth a lot of money. We have only 5,100 square feet, but that's like $6.25 million, which is just mind-boggling. But we have no control because nobody would buy a little tiny 5,100 square footage site. So we can't sell. It has to be with the people on both sides of the sale. And then we said, well, what would happen if we don't sell? Well, that's not an obvious choice we have either, because they said they just box us in. And so we have no choices, selling or not selling. It's just the way it is.
What do you hear in what Gary set forth there in terms of some of the issues, and or are there maybe some other examples that we should get on the table in terms of communities that some of the rest of you come from?
I think the biggest thing is the complexity of the whole thing. I guess that's what's just amazing to me, is that there are no easy answers. Like you talked about, there's no little gambling. The other thing being that people's expectations at the start do not end up being realistic to what happens. Coming from Northeast Iowa, I look back on Iowa's history of, let's get this gambling in, we're going to raise funds for education, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. We're going to, you know, limit this, we're going to limit that, we're going to make sure we have a great support for people that have an addiction problem. And within, what, a year, 2 years, 3 years, most of that was all gone. And then you've got a state that's starting to depend on this for general funds. Mm-hmm. That's one big concern. What it's doing to the individuals, what the state is doing in everyone's name when gambling becomes legalized and they become involved with their own lotteries and so forth. It's just, it's a hugely complex issue. I don't know where you start.
And I think in the case of Iowa, one of the interesting kind of competition between state issues that is raised in this particular study is what happened between Iowa and Illinois. And you know, Iowa started with the riverboats, and then Illinois started, and Iowa at first had very, you know, ceilings on how much could be wagered and won, etc. And that wasn't the case in Illinois. And so basically what happened is, especially with the large population concentration in the Chicago area, and, you know, that basically that forced Iowa to get rid of its limits too. And so it was, you know, it was fast race with one another to see who can outdo one another.
That's another thing too, is that it happens so quickly that we don't have a chance to be thinking out all the issues, and we don't have a chance. It's like, how do you have a chance to fight somebody moving a mountain? You know, it's just, it snowballs. It's so, it just happens so quickly.
It seems to be an interesting acceleration curve kind of across the, you know, the breadth of the culture. The Flacks aren't in Colorado. They're spending part of the winter in Del Mar, California, where they leave to live. Our parish overlooks the famous racetrack at Del Mar, which was built by Bing Crosby and Jimmy Taranti in the 1930s, I think, 1940s. As little as 9 years ago, it was this cute little racetrack that people came in. And for 6 weeks, there was, you know, the racetrack, and people went and they did all the things you do at a racetrack, even a famous one like that. And in the 9 years since Arlene and I have been living and serving this particular parish, the grandstands have all been torn down, and huge new grandstands have been built. An entire satellite wagering complex has been built. So now, instead of just the 8 weeks or so of the race season, which is right this minute, by the way, 6 days a week, now instead of people coming to the Del Mar racetrack to place their wagering bait on horse races in August, now they can come almost 340 days a year. And if the horses aren't at Del Mar, they're at Santa Anita or at Bay Meadows or somewhere, all this satellite wagering, so that you know, I watch these people drive in, you know, day and night, around the clock, around the calendar. And this is, you know, we have two or three Indian, the Native American gambling concessions is a huge fight going on in California. More gambling. The state line areas where California borders Nevada, more, bigger. Las Vegas itself, of course, I drive through on a fairly regular basis. But there's major issues even in the Roman Catholic Church in our community. You know, a little joking about, you know, the so-called, you know, bingo concession is a major gambling issue for that denomination, including St. James Catholic right up the street from us. That's becoming a major part of their revenue, and they wrestle with all of the issues, including addiction that goes on right there within the church, as to terms as how important is this revenue for us. Just spreading throughout all aspects of our culture and society.
Michael, we live near the Rose Bowl, you know, and they've made it sort of like, we can't keep up if we don't put theater-style seats in a press box, and so this is all being done and listening to you, and knowing that they're making more and more days available for soccer. I mean, it's just soccer, you know, and football, but of course there's the whole waging industry on the side for that, and I'm wondering if that can even happen for the Rose Bowl.
Oh, well, I can't even imagine the amount of money that's wagered on college, high school, Little League.
Yeah, I mean, it'll expand like you're talking about Del Mar.
It's you know, I don't know where all this money's coming from.
Yeah.
But when I drive through Las Vegas, on the start of this holiday period, you know, I drove through just before dawn and I looked at the lights of these absolutely astounding casinos. I mean, astounding. They're just amazing to look at. And the winners didn't build them, folks. The losers. That's where all the money comes from, which is almost everybody. Just billions of dollars.
Even try to think of 600, you know, as I said, $600 billion a year being wagered. I mean, it is, you can't begin to wrap your mind around the size of that.
Is it self-limiting? Does anyone feel it is?
We lived in Las Vegas 25 years ago, and the town was about the third of the size it is now. It seemed like it was overblown. Obviously, I was wrong. I mean, but what we call the big casinos when we were there have all now been blown away, and they're all twice and three times as big, with no end in sight.
So there doesn't seem to be a ceiling.
It seemed to me the thing was completely out of control 25 years ago. Obviously, I'm not a very good forecaster, but...
Rent Ocean's 11 and look at those, but now the quite quaint casinos.
From another gambling state, Wisconsin, we have a lot of Native American casinos between Wisconsin, and I live right on the Minnesota line, so we have, it seems like everyone has their own casino. I mean, we have so many, and some of them are huge, and there are many in rural areas as well. We have a very large one in Hinckley, Minnesota, and I guess what I'd like to mention or speak to is how it's changing the community as far as it is becoming the center for the community. The people who go there, they have the finest daycare that we can't even offer in the community. Fabulous daycare facilities. Then for the children that are a little bit older, they have not gambling machines, but they have the other game machines, like the big Nintendo, the interactive computer games. They have a separate place set up for the non-smokers in gambling. And then a place for every group is addressed. They have huge camping grounds for people with RVs. My wife and I have gone there several times because people in the community are using it instead of things that they would normally do, let's say in the church or in the school. They're having their wedding anniversaries there, their wedding receptions. It's a cheap place to eat with very good food. The chefs in the area that are the finest all go to these places because they get paid more. So the other restaurants in the area are really hurting. But everything seems to be sort of being sucked up by the casinos. One of the local Indian leaders said to a group of ministers recently, he said, "I don't know why you're so upset about the casinos, because we have more praying going on there than you do in your churches." And what he said there was a lot of truth to it, because people really are relating to their life more in the casinos than they are anywhere else. And their whole life is getting geared around it. Everything they do, all their entertainment, from with their little children all the way on up to the senior citizens.
In Southern California, no one person in the industry uses the term gambling anymore. It's gaming. It's gaming, which is very telling.
And gaming industry.
The gaming industry
made it even more.
That's no fish.
Associating it exactly with big business, but of course that's another issue.
I want to just say a word about the Native American dimension of this, because I think there are some extra dimensions to all of this that, you know, and you know, clearly, if one's going to become addicted, you know, whether it's on a Native American casino or another, it doesn't really make a lot of difference. But I've been in some discussions, and I think we at least need to be sensitive to what can at times be some racist opposition that rushes in at that point too. Because many Native American leaders will point out the fact that, you know, hey, you know, given the horrendous legacy of how this country has treated Native peoples, the fact that many tribes are now having some economic development and are using the money gained from gambling for schools, for social services, for investments that will better the lives of Indian peoples over the long run, not just for immediate day-to-day kind of existence, becomes, an important kind of argument. I don't think that necessarily says, oh, therefore, that's all okay. But I think it does catch us, those of us who are not Native American, catches us up short about how we object to that. I mean, because I think part of what you're saying, well, okay, if not through gambling, what are other effective long-term means of economic development? And of course, the question of whether it's going to be effective in the long run, I think, remains to be seen, seeing that many have suggested that the market is really getting saturated, and, you know, whether it's a Native American casino or another one, you know, who's going to come? Or is it only going to be the big, you know, the Black Hawk huge casinos, or as well as the Vegas ones that will be have the drawing power?
Yeah, I live in a small town in Washington State, 25,000 people, and we have four Indian tribes in our area, and they've all built casinos. And two of them have gone broke now because there's one tribe that only has 200 members. They had a hard time being declared a tribe, but finally through Washington, D.C., they got declared a tribe. The 200 members went to Harrah's and built a $32 million casino, and that's their livelihood. And they make their money from the Hong Kong Chinese that come from Vancouver, British Columbia, across the border to the USA, to this Harrah's Casino. Mm-hmm. Now with the Asian downturn, they're beginning to lose money, and so the tribe has now severed relationships with Harrah's and are going to try to do it on their own. And the other tribes that have lost have started to say, well, we're going to bring in slot machines, but they're illegal in Washington State. So the one tribe just said, we don't care if it's illegal, we're bringing them in. So they started slot machine gambling, and the Washington State Gaming Commission came in and arrested them all. And then the television cameras came in and showed all the Indians crying. We finally got some pride. We finally had some schools, and we have some dignity that you take away from us. And now you're trying to take it away from us just because we're now affecting you. And then the other thing is that all the local taverns said it's not fair that the Indians should have all this. We should have more things than just slop, whatever, these pull tabs. Mm-hmm. And so they're now getting a bigger piece of the action, and that's hurting the Indians more. And so it's this whole culture of gambling going and competition, and, you know, just, mm-hmm. You wonder where it could ever end.
What is addiction? I guess that's something that I kind of question, because when people spend more money than what they need for their basics and give it to gambling, is that addiction, or is it somebody that would have given money to the church but decides to go out on an entertaining evening and spend it there and kind of slide on their pledge or their donations? Is that addiction?
Well, that may just be questionable stewardship of one's resources.
But is that addiction?
let me give at least the example in the study of what is compulsive or pathological gambler. It's a recognized psychiatric disorder indicated by, quote, a continuous or pure control over gambling. preoccupation with gambling and with obtaining money with which to gamble, irrational thinking, and a continuation of the behavior despite adverse consequences, unquote. And mental health experts also talk about compulsive gambling as a progressive addiction, meaning, you know, there's higher and higher wagers in order to achieve the same high. And second, there is a significant, although it's a contested claim, that an increase in legalized gambling tends to be accompanied by an increased rate of compulsive gambling. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, that's a controversial effect. When we, the person who did the study for us, we pulled together a consultation, and one academician who's done a lot of studying this was very, very much opposed to gambling as, you know, intrinsically wrong. You know, had a whole study, a lot of studies he's done, but those have been disputed by others who say, well, it's hard to say. And as I said earlier, that it's thought that 1 to 5% of the population can be classified as compulsive gamblers for at least part of their lifetime. So I think when we talk about addiction or compulsive gambling, it's those kinds of characteristics that would be a part of that. So I think the addiction is certainly an issue we can't overlook, although part of what I think your example and the other examples that have been set forth here point to is just the way in which it becomes this huge ruling power, totally shaping and reshaping and distorting what we thought of as community and what we thought of as a quality of life that was not dependent on bigger and bigger bets and bigger casinos. And to me, that pervasive issue of what does it say about our character as a people that we find this an increasingly attractive form of recreation.
And increasingly disguised.
Yeah.
Because in Las Vegas now, the biggest attractions are not gambling or gaming casinos. They are amusement parks and recreation things for families and or individuals and or couples that also happen to have casinos attached to them.
Right.
They are rides and entertainment and shows and more and more of everything else follows that pattern too. So bring in the entire community aspect and then lead that off. That's why you can get a full breakfast for $2.99. That's why you continue to be
able. Well, and the fact that in Las Vegas, it's really recreating the world. I mean, New York City is recreated in New York, New York, and you don't have to go, you know, I used to live in New York, and you know, you don't have to deal with all the dirt and the crime, and wow, you can experience Greenwich Village and Ivory Park, you know, all recreated there.
I think there's...
I mean, talk about the created becoming the creator. I mean, talk about a basic, theologically, a basic issue of idolatry, of who, you know, who's God and who's creating, and you know, the moving of the mountain by this casino that you mentioned to me, or not moving it, but getting rid of the mountain.
Karen, I think what Michael's saying is, and this has happened since we moved from Las Vegas, and so we've commented on this next stage. It's kind of the next stage, like you were saying, the seedy atmosphere used to be, and then it became kind of technologically accepted and on the stock market and all. And then they said, well, but we want families to come, and we'll clean it up even more. We'll make it a vacation destination, and the kids can come and play in the amusement park.
But there's a reversal of that now. The last thing I read about Las Vegas for a short time ago was that smaller and smaller, some of these amusement parks, they just weren't, the bottom line wasn't we weren't making enough money. So they're now shrinking them down. Mm-hmm. It wasn't successful, and going back to aiming at the gambling.
But I think there's still two issues there, too, that we're talking about when we're talking about legalized gambling. And it's like what you're saying, too, is does that bring out the addiction, or is that bringing people who have the propensity to the addiction, giving them finally getting access to something that may have never been a problem otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it too is the acceptance and just the general idea. I mean, I think back, and I can't even tell you how many years ago it was that Iowa first started getting into like the scratch-off tickets, and that how opposed some people were to it and wouldn't want to be seen even buying one at the convenience store, to the fact that it's very accepted. And I think, wasn't Hinckley the one that at one time had the slogan, miles from anyone you know, as a reason for coming? I mean, they would never do that now. It's because it's become more and more accepted everywhere, and that's part of the whole snowballing effect, is that these changes come about with some of them major, moving a mountain, some of them so minor we don't notice they're happening. And like even with the talking about the, both of you mentioned the idea of speaking of gaming as opposed to gambling, but somehow if we can find something that's not as objectionable, it becomes accepted to the point we don't even question anymore. That's why I think it's great that everybody's here. I think, to me, it just brings up so many questions that we can't even find answers for. But at least we're still asking or starting to ask the questions. I think that's what's
important. You don't even notice it anymore. There are states that have passed through. You can't even go into a diner and have lunch without facing a Keno screen or a Powerball lottery things. These happen to be illegal in California at the moment, but many states, I mean, just a diner. I mean, just another way to get, just to flow that out. And the whole industry to me feels very much like carbohydrate. There's nothing that's coming out of this except good-looking daycare centers or whatever. There's no community.
What is the product of
it's just pleasure. It's just sugar. It's just empty. It's just glitz. There's no meaning.
Is gambling then the problem, or are we the problem in the fact that we are not willing to do what we need to do to spend the money to create community and to build our schools and to do all those things, but that we want something that gains us some kind of gain for ourselves? We'll buy the ticket because there's some gain for ourselves, but we won't vote for the school levy because we don't have any kids in school anymore.
Yeah, what's in it for me?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that more the problem than the gaming? I mean, the gaming is more, says something about who we are.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that to me is the heart of the ethical issue, of how it really epitomizes what in fact we as a people are becoming.
Yeah.
Then what about the people, wasn't it from Wisconsin, the older couple that won the biggest lottery there ever was in the United States?
They bought their tickets in Wisconsin. They were actually living in Illinois.
Okay, but then wasn't their big thing that they were going to give it all away?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm going to be very curious to know how that happens as the years progress. But Garrison Keillor did a wonderful thing about the couple that won a big lottery and then they ended up, not having things turn out the way they wanted. But I mean, that's certainly another question. I mean, is it possible to be involved in it for the good? Like there you're talking about too, like with the churches using gambling for revenue. Is there a way of it being a good because of the reasons for it? I'm not saying that's good or bad. I don't know. I mean, I think we're kind of all seem to sound real negative.
Yeah, I think the theme of resistance, which I think is one we talk about a lot here at Holden as we need to, I think this raises to me formidable challenges of how we talk about Christians or the church being any kind of force of resistance in the midst of this. I mean, especially given the example here in Blackhawk of this tiny little church with these huge conglomerates now. I mean, even if your church were to say, well, in a sense you have taken a stance of resistance, saying we're not going to take any of those monies for the historic preservation. Then the whole question of, well, if in fact the church were to take very seriously starting a ministry among the casino workers, among whom, at least from what I have heard, there's significant human problems in terms of a lot of casino workers. I know congregations, Lutheran congregations in Atlantic City, who just the human toll that's taken on those families and is itself an incredibly dismal scene.
I just wonder
and therefore the church needs to be there. But then some would probably say, oh, well, you know, we shouldn't have anything to do with any of that. And yet, you know, a stance of remaining pure away from it all seems unrealistic, too.
Karen, just after we talked, you know, and I came down and I looked at the last Friday's New York Times, which, you know, we don't get them up here too soon. The last Friday's, which was July 31st, morning, that was on the front page, was who had won the Powerball. Right. These 13 mm-hmm. assembly line workers. Mm-hmm. And they had driven 8 hours to the ones that went, you know, this was the great example. They'd driven 8 hours to go to a neighboring state. I don't remember what state they were from.
They were from Ohio and they drove to Indiana.
They had to go from Ohio to Indiana to play it. They had to wait or drive 100 miles. That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Drive 100 miles and maybe they had to wait in line to play this.
I just want to add that the church has been struggling with this in a different way. When I was young, the church body I belonged to didn't believe in insurance because that was a form of gambling. And if you couldn't trust the Lord to look after you, then you know, you wouldn't buy insurance because that was gambling. And I remember my father, who was a Lutheran pastor, having a lot of discussions with the church council about whether to put on a lightning rod on the church. Because if you put one on, that was a sign that you didn't trust in the Lord, and that was gambling. And so, I mean, I think it's gone in a way from maybe smaller but ethical confusion to this monstrous thing now that we're dealing with.
Let me just give a slight experience. I lived in Nassau in the early 60s, and it's at that time the issue of gambling came. And the legislature wanted the churches to be involved, and even the legislature looked at it as a moral issue, and it was debated. It was debated in Parliament, whether is it good or bad. The Prime Minister at that time was absolutely opposed morally to have it.
It was in Paradise Island?
Yes, yeah. It was just about what they passed in the early 60s was there was to be one casino, and no resident of the islands was allowed to gamble. It was set up as a European standard, so if you went into that casino, you wouldn't recognize what we do here. Hush and quiet. Men had to wear shirt and tie and coat. This is the tropics, and they had to wear shirt and tie and coat to even walk in. And if you ever, to this day, if you look at advertising from the Bahamas, you do not see gambling as a reason for going there. Sun, pleasure, enjoying the beaches, the whole thing, the whole other thing. And so for at least 30 years, gambling was just this opportunity for European types. We had the international rich of those days who had homes there. And this was something they were used to in Monte Carlo, so why not have it in Palm? And it seemed to have no effect. Most of the islands, of course, had no casino. Didn't affect people directly. And it was kept in tow. I think now there's a lot more pressure to build more casinos because of what's going on here. Yeah. The thing is that how are we going to attract the people with this widespread thing going on in this country? I don't have kept up with what's going on. But it's interesting, for that length of time, it was done in proportion, and it was argued on a moral basis before it ever began. And very restrictive.
You know, on an individual perspective, yeah, it's important to understand what gambling does too. I look at it through the eyes of people that I work with. It becomes a way of life for them that's very captivating and very difficult to get out of. It becomes their recreation. It becomes their goal, their way of hopefully getting wealthy, or at least to be able to pay their debts, maybe. And it becomes their time, because huge amounts of time is invested in being either at the bingo or another type of casino, and they use, you know, when they're at home and not in Las Vegas or somewhere else, they're doing bingo and that sort of thing, and working to make enough money to go back to Las Vegas or a bigger facility where they can. And they go with the idea that they're going to just spend $200 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's always the cash machine there that gets them. And they can't resist getting a little bit more out of that cash machine. That's the way it typically goes. So, you know, it's not the idea that they're going to go there to win money. They don't go there with that idea. They understand the odds at an intellectual level, but not somewhere else. They lose that connection. And it really captures them. It's hard for them. I don't know if you have any information about addictions and recovery when it comes to gambling.
There's some studies cited in here. I did not personally work on this, so I don't in any way claim to be an authority on this topic.
It's not a very good percentage. I don't know that either. It's not a very good percentage. I understand. I don't know how gamblers are now anonymous.
Does anyone else have any knowledge of what those figures are?
But the, you know, the personal aspect and the family aspect of this is really huge too, at the community level.
And it isn't just that, but like you say, at the community level, it's, you know, as a former employer, I have to look at that too, and so do people that live around casinos. It's like, how much is that going to increase the possibility of employee theft? How is that going to affect employee absenteeism? You know, those are the things. It isn't just one little area or an individual or even just a family. It does affect, you know.
And just let one large amount of money be lost on one trip to a casino, and there's always that urge to get that money back. Mm-hmm. Because that was your life savings or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it just hangs there with those people. Mm-hmm. They can't get over that they lost.
Well, as I anticipated, by having a session on this, it brought forth a lot of you who come from communities where this is a very disturbing kind of development. And part of the importance of sharing some of these stories is so that those of us who are in communities where maybe it hasn't